It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll find out what the Dictionary of American Regional English is doing to update itself for a new generation.
But first, the Environmental Protection Agency announced new regulations today to cut power plants' carbon emissions by 30% by the year 2030.
Industry groups are pushing back, saying this could put some power companies out of business and damage the economy. The Obama administration says the change is needed to confront climate change, and incentives for new technology development could actually help stimulate the economy.
WPR reporter Chuck Kornbach joins us now from our Milwaukee studios. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Well, the EPA draft proposal today is part of what's seen as the centerpiece of Obama's climate change policy. What is in President Obama's proposal?
Well, again, there's about a nationwide average of about a 30% cut in carbon dioxide emissions from coal-burning power plants, major contributor to climate change, say the scientists. And so going after the coal-burning power plants has been something that's been in the works for some time. It's been fought over in court, but yet the president has decided to move ahead with the proposal. And it would vary some from state to state. Wisconsin, though, would be about 33% cut target reduction from 2005 levels by the year 2030 or so. Again, there's some flexibility, some variability. And as the public comment period goes over the next 10 or 12 months, I bet there'll be some arguments over what the rate should be in Wisconsin if indeed the plan goes ahead.
Well, more than half the state's electricity comes from coal. We're 14th in the nation in coal use. Given that, does that mean that these new rules are going to be any more difficult for Wisconsin, say, than another state with lower coal use?
Well, again, a point of debate. I mean, the EPA is saying that there's flexibility for the states. No state is similar, and that there'd be some various ways to come up with this 30% roughly reduction. Things such as burning coal more efficiently, more use of renewable energy in the state. And, of course, there's been a growth of solar and wind power in Wisconsin and many other states. More utilities switching to natural gas, which is less of a greenhouse gas problem from natural gas, but certainly some. And more use of energy efficiency so that we're burning perhaps less coal to run certain projects, to run certain appliances and things like that. All sort of all hands on deck, all things sort of adding up, say the EPA and environmental groups that support that, there will be flexibility.
And what is the response so far from Wisconsin utility companies?
Well, they haven't been saying a whole lot. Xcel out in the western part of the state has wanted some clarity, I think, and because they also are moving ahead in, on things like wind and so on. Governor Walker today in Milwaukee said that if it's really flexibility, then it's something that's potentially encouraging to him. He says that there have been promises not just from the Obama administration but others in the past saying we'll give you flexibility, and then the flexibility does not occur. But he says if it's real flexibility, there's a potential upside for the state. He says if Wisconsin can make green by going green, in other words, if there's ways this can stimulate the economy in a certain direction. He didn't exactly give a thumbs up just yet, but a cautious optimism about it. However, just a few months ago, the Walker administration did send the EPA a letter raising some concerns because we get so much electricity in the state from coal-fired power plants, and a lot of the state's economy is dependent on manufacturers who need a lot of electricity. Walker and others don't want electricity prices at these manufacturers to shoot up and cause headaches for the product makers.
And as I understand it, one question on the table in Wisconsin has been, will Wisconsin get credits for past energy reductions and emissions that we've apparently been incorporating over the past year or two? And is that going to count toward these standards?
Right. And that is, and it's probably more than a year or two. And also factor in that some of the reductions came about, as the NPR spot a moment ago said, through the recession, that there was less use of electricity by manufacturers because some went out of business or cut back and so on. And there was therefore some reduction in carbon dioxide emissions just because the economy was going sour for a while. So there's been some reductions via that. There's been some reductions by power plants getting rid of coal and changing to natural gas, or putting in a big new collection, you know, ways to collect carbon dioxide emissions and not let as much out into the atmosphere, or burning coal more efficiently, sort of the all hands on deck approach I mentioned before. So yes, there'll be some debate over, well, we did this, don't we get credit for it? And it's not just, of course, President Obama that will have a role in deciding that, but the next president and the president perhaps beyond that.
Is there any word about whether Wisconsin could be involved in a cap and trade plan with credits the way other states are?
Well, I think there's some initial skepticism about that, but it has been the case in some other types of emissions. There's been cap and trade going on, and again, cap and trade is the idea of buying and selling of emissions credits, that companies that do well at reducing emissions might sell credits to companies that are having problems meeting reductions, with the overall goal of either limiting carbon dioxide emissions, or hopefully they would say cutting carbon dioxide emissions. It's sort of a complex thing. I was listening to a conservative station today that was raising a big hue and cry about cap and trade. But it has to work to some degree, whether it can with carbon dioxide, which is such a prevalent pollution, type of pollution, devil in the details there.
And the letter, rather, that you referenced earlier that Governor Walker had sent regarding these emissions and the plan which was coming down the pipeline, the question that he raised was some legal issues, as he saw it, still out there in the field that needed to be dealt with. Where is that, do you think, right now as we look at these new emission standards?
Well, they sent the letter, but the EPA and White House went ahead with a plan today. So there's not every state concern is going to be listened to, but there may be court attempts by groups, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the coal industry, and others that don't like these reductions. If they take their arguments to court, they may incorporate some arguments from states like Wisconsin as to whether, as I say, whether this is doable, whether it would cause a large increase in electricity prices, and other sorts of ways that this would play out.
Now, President Obama hasn't acted on carbon emission standards at this level until now. Why did he pick this moment?
Well, there's been some national news reports that suggest he is trying to sort of make his mark on this issue before he leaves office. There's certainly, I think, the previous EPA Administrator Lisa Jackson did a lot of outreach to minority communities and talking about asthma, because this reductions would have not only carbon dioxide reductions, but there could be potentially gains in the slicing of other pollutants that lead to asthma and other breathing problems. And Jackson and Obama have been paying attention to the sort of side benefits, if you will, of better, more efficient burning of coal. But he's also, as I say, the president also been promising for a number of years to move ahead, and has now done so. Perhaps is exerting more executive power than the Republicans would like, but again, trying to make a mark, before he leaves office, again, with the uncertainty of what would happen after he leaves office.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Chuck Kornbach, our WPR reporter based in Milwaukee.
In 1965, University of Wisconsin students and researchers set out in word wagons to record the ways Americans spoke in different parts of the country.
Now, nearly 50 years later, they're tracing how language uses change, substituting computers and online survey methods for those original wagons, all to update the Dictionary of American Regional English.
With us now is Joan Houston Hall. She's chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English and senior scientist of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's an expert on American English and all those regional and social variations. Joan, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, let's start. About 50 years ago, we saw a photo of a couple of the original researchers standing next to the camper, the Word Wagon, collecting, like, documenting the way we talk. What did that tell us about American English and how it varied around the country?
Well, those field workers in their word wagons went to 1,002 communities across the country and asked people who had lived there all their lives to answer thousands of questions in a huge questionnaire. And what we discovered is that there were many, many regional patterns about the way people use words. Some showed that Wisconsinites use words that aren't heard elsewhere, and that's what we're trying to discover this time, whether those words are still characteristic of this area or whether they've changed.
So you said some words were characteristic of Wisconsin. What were the words that you were looking at 50 years ago?
Oh, we looked at words dealing with all parts of our lives, from time to weather to food, clothing, animals, farming, religion, health, disease, all sorts of things. And within all those categories, there were many different patterns. So for Wisconsin, words like flowage, for instance, we found to be characteristic only of Wisconsin. Now, if we do this new survey nationwide, we'll be really interested to see whether people in other parts of the U.S. have adopted that term.
Now, the bad news here is you're not gearing up for a big road trip. You're not going out in the word wagons this time around.
That's right. That was very expensive and very time-consuming. So this time, we're doing an online survey. We're working with the University of Wisconsin Survey Center, and we have put up the survey, which is available for Wisconsin residents to go to and answer questions as they like.
So is it up there right now, ready to go?
It is indeed. And you can get there easily just by going to the DARE site, which is www.dare.wisc.edu. And there is a button on the left side that says Online Wisconsin Survey.
It's fascinating stuff. So do you expect much to have changed? I imagine 50 years is a long time of language evolution.
It is a long time, and it's a very good question. One popular notion is that because we're a very mobile population and because we listen to many of the same media, our English has become, quote, homogenized. Mm-hmm. That's a popular notion, but I don't think it's true. Language changes, yes, of course, but it doesn't change at the same rates or in the same ways in all places. So what we're hoping to find is how homogenized our language has become. And I am quite convinced that we will still find many, many differences from one place in the country to another.
And it's not necessarily just a matter of did this regional word or phrase survive, but I would think that different regions are still inventing and coming up with new words that maybe start in one state or part of a state.
Yes, that's always true. We invent words as we need them. And many people think that commercial terms will take over for local food items, say. But if there's no reason to adopt a nationwide term, we're perfectly happy to hold on to the things that have been important to us all our lives.
Now, we have a lot of Wisconsin words. Bubbler is one that we associate with Wisconsin, at least southeastern Wisconsin for sure. And it seems as though those are still kicking around. Just anecdotally, are you seeing changes as you talk to people in the state and as you travel?
Well, bubbler is, of course, one that is very dear to the hearts of Wisconsinites. And certainly it's true that if you look at the United States, this is the heart of bubbler country. But it's not the only place where people use the term. There are places in Massachusetts and Rhode Island and in Portland, Oregon, where people talk about bubblers. But here it's especially strong and probably goes back to the Kohler Company in the early part of the 20th century, when they marketed in the part of the country that now uses the term bubbler.
You're seeing, or you're in the midst of this internet survey, are you looking at results as they come in, or are you going to wait until you're all done and then start crunching the words?
We've looked just casually at the results, but we won't do any real analysis until we're done.
Off the top of your head, though, any fun stuff coming in or surprising or, you know, words that stuck around that we might not have expected to?
Well, I can't go that far yet.
Oh, okay.
What are some favorites from the past? Do you remember? I see you've got a list of words in front of you there.
Yeah, there are lots of food items that are very Wisconsin, mm-hmm. or maybe Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. And that's natural, of course, because many of them reflect our ethnic heritage. So words like booyah, for instance, is very Wisconsin, and it's restricted within the state. Mm-hmm. To the area around, say, Appleton and east of there in small communities along the lake. Things like German potato salad, for instance, which people think is totally logical, is not something that is recognized elsewhere. And foreign terms like kolachki and kringle and krumkaka and lefse and punchki and lutefisk, of course. But even things like squeaky cheese. I had never heard of squeaky cheese, and I didn't know what cheese curds were. And although those have spread some in the last decades, I'm sure that they are still relatively regional. But in addition to food words, there are lots of others. The tradition of the golden birthday, for instance, is very Wisconsin.
Really? I don't think I'd ever heard of it before I moved here. So that makes sense. That hadn't occurred to me. That was a Wisconsin thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the supper club tradition, mm-hmm. of course, is very Wisconsin. Terms like trunk roads, take County Trunk M. Hmm. That's a local term. And one of my favorites is the term winter potato. Do you know a winter potato?
Mm-mm. No.
A winter potato is a rounded rock that comes to the surface of a farmer's field in the winter as the ground thaws and freezes.
A winter potato, I like that.
So when you get your field ready in the spring, it might be crowded with winter potatoes, and that's not a good thing.
Only when they're out.
Okay.
Wow, it's so fun hearing these. I can't help but feeling that if these are gone now, it would be kind of sad to lose these words. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're lost, but we'll tell you in another year.
So in the later years of the project, the Regional English Project so far, some of the ones we were talking about just now came from ethnic groups, from farming talk. Are there new drivers of new regional words now? Food, I imagine, will always be, but any others?
Well, I'm sure that with the increasing numbers of Hispanic speakers, we will adopt new words that weren't part of our vocabulary before. Many of the other ethnic terms that still remain do reflect things like Norwegian heritage, mm-hmm. with words like ish and ishi rather than ik and icky, and ufta, which is, of course, very Wisconsin and Minnesota. And card games are very reflective of our German heritage. Sheep's head, Schafskopf, Schmier, all of them very distinctive of this part of the country.
And you're looking at the country as a whole, right? So it's not just Wisconsin. And what about some of our neighbors? Do you recall any of the interesting words from, say, Illinois or Minnesota?
Well, in the early survey, we did do the whole country. Now we're concentrating only on Wisconsin because we hope to find out whether this online survey is workable in the whole country. But Minnesota has lots of interesting words, like the name for what we would call a rubber band. It's a rubber binder in Minnesota. And lots of other Norwegian food words are common there.
Well, we were just talking. I was talking to our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, both of us from Michigan, and we were talking about Coney dogs. And I was in a hot dog place in Madison a while back, and they had Coney sauce. And I asked the guy at the counter, "Are you from Michigan?" "No, but the owner is." So it's one of those things. These are words that when somebody says them, a lot of the time, you know where they're from. So if you run into somebody talking about bubblers elsewhere in the country, good chance they're from Wisconsin.
Yes, indeed. But on the other hand, if you go to O'Hare and ask somebody, "Where's the nearest bubbler?" They're not likely to understand you.
And I was wondering if you could give people the website once more for people who want to take the survey before we run out of time.
Yes, www.dare.wisc.edu. Look for the button on the left-hand side.
Joan, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
That was Joan Houston Hall, chief editor of the Dictionary of American Regional English, senior scientist of English at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Remember math class? Do you remember it fondly, or did you go through your classes thinking, I'm never going to use this stuff?
Our next case makes the case that developing our math skills can make us better thinkers and help clarify the way we look at politics, the economy, sports, and our daily lives.
Jordan Ellenberg joins us now. He's professor of mathematics at UW-Madison. His new book is How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. Jordan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, I'm sure everybody who's ever taught a math class dreads that question or statement, I'm never going to use this stuff. How do you answer that?
Well, first of all, we do dread it, and the truth is that we don't dread it because it's a bad question. We dread it because it's a really good question, a question that people should be asking us. And in many ways, I don't think our curriculum is set up to really offer a good answer to that question. Sometimes we teach a lot of very formal strategies, a lot of very abstract manipulations, but the truth is that math is not an alien, abstract thing that's separate from our life. It's really woven into the way we think.
And let's follow up that thinking theme. It seems like, if nothing else, when I've done math, I feel like a different brain muscle kicking in or something. Mm-hmm. Is math a good mental exercise?
Oh, I think it certainly is. But again, I think in some sense, doing mathematics is a formalization of thinking carefully. So I hope that when you think carefully about something, you're feeling some of the same muscles exercise that when you carry out a formal mathematical manipulation, if you have cause to do so.
Well, you start off early in the book with one example you offer as an answer to how does mathematical thinking help us out in the real world. And you go back to World War II, I think it was fighter planes and the armor on them. Can you tell us how a mathematician solved that problem?
Yeah, this is an amazing story. And actually, I didn't know it when I started writing the book. I came across it while I was researching and immediately felt, oh, I have to lead with this. So it's so it's the story of Abraham Wald, who was a statistician who worked for this sort of top secret math lab during World War II. You probably didn't even know there was a top secret math lab. That's how secret it was. Called the SRG, the Statistical Research Group. And what happens is that the generals come to the SRG and they say, well, we're looking at these planes coming back from Germany and we're seeing that they're not being hit evenly across the planes. There's more bullets on the fuselage, less bullets on the engine. Mm-hmm. How much more armor should we put on the fuselage in order to protect the planes?
Right, and I want to jump in. So the obvious answer, there's more shots per square foot in the fuselage. I'm a general. I want more armor on the fuselage.
Right, you want more armor where the planes are getting hit. And what Abraham Wald says is, no, you got to put the armor where the bullet holes are not. Because the point is that it's not that the planes are not getting hit on the engine. It's that the planes that are getting hit on the engine are the ones that are not coming back. Okay, so what's going on here?
Right.
Is this math, after all, what I just told you? There's no formula. There's no equation. There's no trigonometry. Now, by the way, if you look at Wald's actual report, there's plenty of formulas and equations. Don't get me wrong. I'm not fit for public radio, so we'll hide it. But the point is that he's being a mathematician in that he's questioning the assumptions. He's saying, what assumptions are you making? Are they valid? Did you prove them? Should we think about them? And that's very much the mathematical habit of mind, even if it's not about a computation like you might see in math class.
And he went through and did the computations that show what we'd expect to see if the ones getting hit in the engine were then crashing and not returning, not joining the sample that the generals were working with.
Exactly, which conforms exactly with what the generals were seeing.
And that brings us to the title of the book, How Not to Be Wrong. When we're confronting a problem, an issue in our daily lives, how can we activate our math mind to question those assumptions that leap out at us right off the bat?
Well, I think what you just said, question your assumptions, is a really good place to start because that is what mathematicians always do. Maybe one way I put it in the book is that it's very good to argue against yourself, to the things that you sort of take for granted, to sort of say, well, let me take maybe 20 minutes a day just to sort of say, what if I didn't believe that? What if I believed the opposite of that? What happens if I try to put pressure on my beliefs?
You mentioned that math is often taught in a very formulaic way, or a lot of formulas and formal ways of looking at math. Is there a way to bridge the gap and do that? I assume we still need to do that, but also take this real-world problem-solving approach to make it feel a little more vital?
Yeah, well, that's the question we as math educators have been wrestling with for at least the last 100 years or more. Mm-hmm. It's a real challenge. I think the teachers in this state and around the country are out there very much trying to do exactly that. I think the days when we thought that it was sufficient in math teaching just to generate a cadre of students who can mindlessly follow directions and we no longer think that's enough, and it's been decades since we thought that was enough.
Is the answer the dreaded story problem?
Well, story problems, and actually the state of story problems is a perfect example of how this can go wrong, because I think in the abstract you would say, oh, you sort of connect the problem with a real world thing so that it's more relevant or sort of connects with people's intuition more. But in fact, we've somehow come up with a way of writing story problems which are just the formal problem in disguise. If we say, you know, Julie has 30 marbles and she gives half as many marbles as she has plus 5 more to Rob. I mean, who plays marbles, right? it's just the algebraic problem, like, in a very, very poor disguise.
But isn't it that getting us halfway there? Because if half of your students are ending up having Julie having negative 30 marbles or pi marbles or some really wrong answer, and that's what their calculations, it at least invites you to make a check of common sense and the units you're using against the number you came up with?
Well, I hope so. And that's a point I try to make repeatedly in the book. The phrase I use is that mathematics is the extension of common sense by other means. We have to bring common sense to mathematics. And what I say is, if I have a student who gives an answer like negative 30 marbles, if they write that answer and circle it, you know, they're going to get a zero, right? But if they write that answer and say, here's what I got, but I know this can't be right because there can't be negative 30 marbles, that's much more credit, because that is actually mathematics, right? I mean, after all, doing a computation, the computer can do now, mm-hmm. right? But actually thinking about what computation that you should do and whether the answer makes sense, that is mathematics, not just adding and subtracting.
Well, they could be doing some kind of complicated credit default swap involving marbles, I suppose, where negative marbles are possible. Well, another case where you want people to question the logic, you point out a study that shows all Americans are going to be obese, I think, by the year 2024.
Yeah, it's 2048, I think. We have a little bit more time.
Okay. So that's they took the current trends, the current increase, and drew a straight line, and at 2048, 100% of us will be obese. What's wrong with looking at it that way?
Well, this is a perfect example, because this is called the method of linear regression, drawing the best fit straight line that you can to the data that you have. And I would never say that people shouldn't do this. It's one of the basic tools of all kinds of science. Certainly we should do it, but when we do it, I mean, and it works in basically any kind of situation. It's very easy. You can do it pressing one button in Excel. That's the strength of the method, but it's also its weakness, because the fact that it works all the time means that, or works in scare quotation marks, means that you have to actually ask yourself whether the answer you get makes sense. I mean, they're a straight line. It says in 2048, everyone will be obese. But it also says that 10 years after that, 120% of Americans will be obese. So what do we take from that?
Right. So when we're assessing a problem like that, we've got what looks like a linear trend, and we want to figure out what's going to happen in the future. How do we figure out when we can keep drawing that straight line? And this is just ballparking. You know, we're citizens looking at these numbers in a news story. How do we figure out when it makes sense to keep going straight and when that line should taper off, curve a little bit?
Well, this is the kind of thing where giving precise numerical answers to the questions, I mean, that's why we have professional statisticians. That's what they're all doing. What the sort of ordinary lay citizen can do is ask what shape of curve makes sense. Which is exactly as you said, without any statistical training, you recognize correctly that what's going to happen is that curve is going to bend towards 100%. It has to. There's not literally going to be no skinny people left in the United States.
Well, and I want to take another example, a vital one in politics. And you say that non-mathematical thinking is maybe steering people on all sides of politics wrong a little bit. Say tax rates. If we have a tax rate of 100%, bad things ensue. I think pretty much everybody agrees with that.
Right.
People stop doing stuff. 0% tax rate, the government doesn't get any money. But what's gone wrong with that? How do we look at it in a linear way versus a curvy way?
Well, so a linear way, it's exactly what we were just discussing with obesity. The nature of a linear relationship is that it only moves in one direction. So in the obesity, it would be to say that as time goes forward, people just get more and more obese at the same rate. And in the language of taxes, it would be to say that as taxes go up, government revenue goes up. But as you just explained, that can't be true because at a certain point, the taxes become so high that government revenue actually goes down. That's sort of a famous old thing called the Laffer curve. Mm-hmm. Now, whether we've actually ever been at that point is a highly contested question. I think most economists would say we have never been there, despite what many people in the 80s wanted to say. But linear means that no matter what, more taxes means more money. Or if something is a good idea, then doing more of it is always better. Put that way, it's sort of obviously false.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So one reaction I had to reading some of your examples, and I imagine a lot of people might, is to say that this isn't math. That's politics. The other thing is health. I'm not adding and subtracting. I'm not doing quadratic equations myself. I'm not applying mathematical thinking.
Well, but I think you are applying mathematical thinking in that these questions about what are the properties of lines, that is a fundamentally mathematical question. Now, you may think it's easy, but if it were easy, people wouldn't so consistently get these things wrong.
We're talking to UW math professor Jordan Ellenberg. We're talking about his new book, How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking.
We continue our conversation with Jordan Ellenberg, the author of How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking.
And you can join in. Are you a math fan or math phobic? Do you teach math at any level? How do you try to make the case that it's worthwhile? How do you keep your students interested in the math? And what's your favorite or least favorite bit of math that you've encountered? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org. By the way, Jordan Ellenberg will be talking at Mystery to Me Books in Madison Wednesday at 7, and then at a TEDx event in Madison, along with other speakers as well. Well, I want to get into improbability and improbable events, Jordan. I think all of us have encountered some event in our lives, thought, what are the odds against that? Something must be behind that. It's such a unique thing to have happened. How do we assess whether something's really that crazily out of the ordinary?
Well, it's a challenge, and part of the reason it's a challenge is that our brains are just not that good at it. In some sense, we're probably designed not to be very good at it. We're designed to see something that looks strange or unusual and notice it, try to make something of it. But in fact, you know, the world is a very big place, and given enough chances for something to improbable happen, it almost definitely will. You could say we live in a coincidence-rich environment.
And this is a problem that goes back and forth in scientific and particularly medical research, isn't it?
Absolutely. So, I mean, one of the things that science is wrestling with right now is partly because we have such a greater ability than we used to be able to carry out many, many experiments, many, many comparisons on a short time scale. We used to be able to say the result of such and such an experiment would be so improbable if the drug didn't work or if the effect weren't there that we can be pretty confident that something is really going on. But now we're in a situation with, you know, tens of thousands of papers being published every year. Inevitably, even if we're studying things that are not real, there's going to be some improbably coincidental things that look like they're major scientific advances. So this is a serious problem that science has been reckoning with.
So there is a probability that some of a huge number of studies will give an improbable result.
Right. The example I give in the book is that if all scientists were simply reading sheep entrails and trying to predict the future, now we think they're not, but imagine that they were. If there were 10,000 sheep entrail readers, some fairly large proportion of them, or some fairly large number of them, rather, would actually get impressive results, right? Like 10 of them would get 1 in 1,000 type results. Mm-hmm. And if we grabbed those 10 guys and were like, these are the best sheep entrail readers in the country, we might be making a terrible mistake.
And we might end up with that survivorship bias like the fighter planes again, right? If we only pay attention to the sheep guys who are right and dismiss all the rest, we'd have a lot of faith in the sheep.
Right. As they say, past performance is no guarantee of future returns, right? And if you took those same entrail readers and saw how they did next time, you might be quite disappointed in their findings.
Let's get to our callers. We've got Connie on the line in Portage. Connie, hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I am an RN, and I had to take algebra in college. And I couldn't see any reason for it, and I was 40 when I started nurses training, and my professor kept saying, oh, Connie, it'll round you out. Well, never did I ever have the need for algebra being a nurse. I think more clinical would have helped, things like that. And my boys are all fantastic in math and use it in their jobs, but I think there's a time and a place for algebra. And that was all my comment that I had to say.
Connie, thanks for the call. Apart from being well-rounded, Jordan, do you want to make the case for a nurse doing algebra, or might there be another way to train us in math that would help us think like a nurse or as a nurse?
Well, here's what I would say. Algebra in the sense of, can you see a list of 20 quadratic equations and solve them all in 15 minutes? Like, no, you're probably not going to do that as a nurse. And guess what? I actually also don't do that as a professional mathematician. In fact, nobody does that who's not in eighth grade. I hate to break it to all the kids out there who are listening, to break it to their teachers, but that's how it is. But if algebra is doing math in reverse and saying, okay, I need 10 more of these, and I'll have 50. How many do I have? That is algebra, right? That's solving x plus 10 equals 50. It may not be expressed in that way, but that is algebraic thinking, and that is much more like something that you would have to do in life.
Oh, and you make a point. It's something along, I think you use soccer, but say no football players go out on the field and run in tires and run right into inert dummies and things like that, but they still do it.
They still do it when they practice, and nobody says it's not useful for them to do it. Somehow that builds the kind of instinctive skills that they need in order to run away from 300-pound men instead of tires.
Thanks a lot for the call, Connie. We'll go now to Abby with us in Madison. Hi, Abby.
Hi. I am mathematically inclined, and I always enjoyed it. Some of my favorite teachers in school were math teachers, and I am actually dating a math teacher now. But I found that math has been tremendously useful in my life. I'm a PA, and I think it gave me a way to solve problems. If I looked at a problem, it gave me a formula of building blocks of how to go about solving that problem, and I could apply it to a lot of different fields of my study.
Abby, thanks so much for that call. Jordan, that's kind of what you're making the case for.
Yeah, I couldn't have said it better, actually, that it's the habits of thought, whether or not they're expressed in what looks like a high school math textbook format that we're really trying to teach.
Abby, thanks so much for sharing that. We go now to Joe in Prairie du Chien. Joe, hi.
Hi. I was a carpenter for years, and I use math constantly to create roof slopes, rafter links, stairs, and so on. But I'm also curious, is the advent of the calculator diminishing the ability to actually understand the mathematics?
Oh, interesting. What do you think, Jordan?
Well, It's a deep question and hard to measure. You could look at it two ways. You could say that people replacing hand computation with calculators may diminish their ability to do hand computations, and I certainly think that's true. Somebody who is more pro-calculator might argue that offloading the computation itself to the calculator might leave more mental room to think about and understand what's going on. If you can have the calculator sort of do 100 questions for you, or you modify it and see how things changes, or better, a computer, maybe that will aid students' understanding. That's certainly the hope of people who are working with tech in the classroom.
But is it important to at least have done the calculation, you know, some before we start turning to the calculator, so we know what went into what the calculator is telling us?
Well, I have strong opinions about this. You want to hear them?
Yes.
So multiplication tables, yes, definitely. Long division, no, I don't care. Again, for the kids out there, I don't care if you know how to do long division, but I do care about multiplication tables.
My kids are probably listening. Long division is still important if your teacher is telling you that, kids. This is controversial in math education, I would think.
Oh, my God. If you go to like a math dinner party, I mean, you can talk about Scott Walker, or you can talk about religion, or you can talk about climate change or whatever, but do not talk about math education. Like, then somebody will leave in a huff. I can promise you that. It is the ultimate controversy for us.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call. We've got Steele on the line in Appleton. Steele, hi.
Hey, thanks so much. I learned on TED Talks about Khan Academy, and I've played with his math classes, and it was a lot better than in high school. That's all I got to say.
Steele, thanks. Are we, not to get back to the controversial math education topic, but are we slowly, asymptotically moving closer to perfect math education?
Well, it would definitely be slowly, that I could say. I mean, I think stuff like Khan Academy is amazing. And I think in some sense, what many people are trying to do, what I'm trying to do with the book and what somebody like Salman Khan is trying to do with Khan Academy, is find ways to take teaching and do it at a larger scale. I don't think anybody thinks we can really replace teaching with that. I think there's always going to be this dialectic between what we can do with one person physically there with a room full of students, or even better, one person with one student talking to them, but also things that we can direct out to thousands, or in Salman's case, millions of people at once.
So we've talked a lot about teaching kids. Steele is a grown-up who's going and learning math. Say we've got other people like Steele out there, didn't really maybe get much out of math or remember much. Is there a field of math that would be a good entry point for people to get back into it and fall in love with it?
Oh, great question. I'm going to sort of say something kind of risky. I would say probability and statistics. Mm-hmm. The reason I say that is because I think it's something that most people didn't learn in high school. So it has the flavor of the new. It can be kind of depressing to like take algebra again when you're 40 years old, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, to do something new, sort of somehow more exciting. The reason it's risky is because I think that subject, as I was saying, is fundamentally pretty hard for us to learn. It's a challenge, right? We're not necessarily automatically good at reasoning about uncertainty, but that's one thing that makes it exciting.
But you can use dice and playing cards and flip coins. That makes it a lot of fun for me.
Absolutely. And it's certainly one of the most relevant and applied areas of math that you could possibly learn.
We'll leave it there for now. Jordan, thank you so much for coming up and joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Jordan Ellenberg. He's professor of mathematics at UW-Madison. We've been talking about his new book, How Not to Be Wrong, The Power of Mathematical Thinking. And he's talking in Madison this Wednesday at Mystery to Me Books. That's Wednesday at 7 o'clock.